Welcome to episode number 282 of the Seahawkers podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers, and joining me, my good buddy and Montana Seahawker, Adam Emmert.
Last podcast of the 2019 season. I feel like it finished two games short.
It was two games short, three wins short. And I'm going to remember this year, Adam. I'm going to remember it very well as the most stressful season of Seahawks football that I've ever followed week in, week out.
That's hilarious because I feel like we say that at the end of every season. And it's, you know, it's just the way the team plays. And, you know, we'll get into that more later on in the podcast. But they take on the Packers in Lambeau and, you know, come back and make a valiant effort and dang near pull it off. And it was sort of indicative of the year, no doubt about it.
28-23, the final score. The Seahawks were down at halftime once again in the divisional round, 21-3. But they come back, they score in their first possession coming out of the half. A Marshawn Lynch touchdown, his third of four touchdowns since returning to the team. And they go on, they do allow the Packers another second half touchdown on, gosh, a frustrating play to Davante Adams, who frustrated the Seahawks defense all day long. But, you know, two more touchdowns, they get within 5 points. And, you know, if you think about it, they had the missed 2-point conversion. They had a missed field goal in the first half. I mean, if you just even make up those points, it's a tie game.
Right. Or even if Myers does make that field goal, I mean, now we're talking, it's a 2-point game going down the stretch there. And that can definitely change things as well.
Yeah.
It was definitely frustrating when he missed that. Although a 50-yard field goal in 20-degree weather in Lambeau in January, that's a long ass kick. But yeah, there's a lot of different plays in this game that could have gone just slightly different. And we're talking about a totally different game. And many of those were just throws on third down that Aaron Rodgers was able to make with consistency that he hasn't done all year with that sort of consistency. And, you know, even some that felt super lucky that even Aaron Rodgers, you could see on his face, was like, wow, I got a horseshoe all the way up my ass today. And like that throw to Geronimo Allison towards the end of the game.
Yeah.
That was another big moment in the game. And you could just see it all over Rodgers' face. Just like, wow, I can't believe that. So just the gods at the end of the day just were not in our favor.
Geronimo Allison's one catch of the day, that one on third down for an 11-yard reception for the first down. And yeah, going down the stretch, I could be upset with the defense in some respects, you know, giving up some of those third downs, giving up 21 points in the first half. You know, if the defense is able to keep it a little bit closer, and obviously the Seahawks, you know, that there weren't a whole lot of drives even to look at in the first half. I think each team had, what, four drives each. And one Correct. Of those drives was the Seahawks at the very final drive, you know, trying to get some points on the board. Wilson ends up throwing a Hail Mary. So there wasn't a lot to work with in the first half. But the defense, yeah, I would have liked to see them get, you know, at least hold one of those touchdowns to a field goal and keep the team in it just a little bit closer. I feel like I'm repeating myself, though, as to how first halves of games have gone almost this entire season, especially in losses.
Really, you know, as long as Pete Carroll has been the coach, the games have kind of gone this way. And we'll get into that a little bit more later on in the show. But, you know, some people wringing their hands over the coaching. And, you know, you talked about the defense in that first half. And when I'm looking at the coaching here, I'm most angry with Ken Norton just because I don't know if you had the same feeling, Brandon, because I kind of went dark for the game just to watch it by myself and, you know, have my own thoughts about it, right?
Yeah.
But holy smokes. I mean, right out of the gate, well, number one, coming into that game, you know that Aaron Rodgers has one weapon and one weapon only. His name is Adams, and that's the guy you need to key on. And yet somehow they didn't double him on every single passing opportunity, or at least the majority of them.
Right.
And he tore them up. And it wasn't until, you know, in the second half, and I don't know exactly when you could pinpoint, when, probably the first drive in the second half for the Packers, they started double teaming Davante Adams. And it's like, why does it take so long to make that adjustment on defense? offensively, I wasn't that frustrated because, like you said, they go through that first half, and because the Packers had the ball for so damn long, they barely had opportunities to do anything on offense, you know, let alone, you know, just turn it over to Russ or stop running the ball or run the ball more, whatever it is that you feel like should have happened in that first half. There just wasn't that many opportunities because of how piss poor the defense played early on in the game.
Yeah, time of possession for the Seahawks just in the first half. They had it for 12 minutes. The Packers had it for 18. And, you know, you mentioned that adjustment to Adams. And I would say going into this game, for me, it was two guys. It was Aaron Jones and it was Devontae Adams. And one of the reasons why Aaron Rodgers has had so much success this year is partially because he's had a defense for the first time in a long time. And he's had a running game for the first time in a long time. And it's not just Jones running it out of the backfield. He's also a guy that Rodgers likes to throw to. So, you know, they actually held him pretty much in check in the first half. Jones, you know, rushed for 46 yards in the first half. He had one catch out of the backfield. He didn't even have his catch on the first half. He just he threw his direction one time. And they were able to keep Jones relatively in check in that first half. I mean, I guess he did have.
He had the two touchdowns. He had the one big run on the first drive. I think it was the first play of the game.
Right.
And then, I mean, we'll talk about the touchdowns real quick. I mean, you talked a little bit about the idea of it would have been nice if they had held him to a field goal somewhere in that stretch. And man, they damn near did on one of those goal line stands. I mean, it came down to, you know, an inch, if not less, that I honestly believe a lot of people bitch about the Jimmy Graham spot late in the game. Whereas I thought the goal line stand there was far more egregious. Like, they stopped him before he got across the goal line. That was pretty clear to me. That was frustrating there because the defense did bow up and try to keep him out. And, you know, the referees gave it to him. And honestly, too, in that first half, we hang a lot on the defense, but, you know, there's a couple drives there that were very much extended by penalties that were, you could call them, they were ticky-tack, like the pass interference on Shaq. That was tough. I mean, yes, he got his hands on him, but he didn't push him around. He didn't, you know, impede the receiver's progress, anything like that. That's something that's not usually called. It can be called in the spirit of the rule.
Sure.
There were some other calls along the way that were, you know, dubious that kept the Packers moving down the field. And really, that was a big part of the defense's failure in the first half.
Well, and if you're going to call that on Shaquille Griffin, I mean, don't you? I mean, there's some pretty egregious holding calls, that at least one that they missed on the 3rd and 5 for the Seahawks late in the game when Russell Wilson was sacked on that 3rd and 5, I think it was, where I think it was Tyler who was in the slot and dude just had his arms wrapped around him. And Russell goes down for the sack. They end up having to punt it away on 4th and 11. But let's talk about some of these calls late in the game, because I think we mentioned some of our frustrations with the defense early on. And I guess in terms of the offense, not able to really get it going on the first couple drives. I know a lot of the people in the never punt camp looked at that 4th and 1 on the Seahawks second drive. You know, after Marshawn Lynch gets 8 yards on first down, and they go back-to-back plays. They only pick up 1 yard. It's 4th and 1, and it was on the Seahawks' side of the field. And the Seahawks were supposed to go for it in that situation, and in that early in the game, down only 7 points. And you've had two successful plays so far. One was a throw to Jacob Hollister that he fumbled, that the Seahawks were fortunate that the replay didn't show a clear recovery on. And then the second best play was the one that was two plays before, where Marshawn Lynch ran for 8 yards.
Right, exactly. And then people outraged that on that drive after Marshawn has an 8 yard rip of a run, that they have the audacity to go back and run it again on two short yardage plays. Like, what idiots? I mean, you can't possibly do that. That's terrible football. It makes too much sense to follow up a great running play with hopefully another great running play. That can't possibly happen. Like that, and then criticizing him for not going on fourth down there. Like, what? Are you the guy that goes into the casino and throws down all your chips on black every single time? Like, is that who you are? Like, I mean, there's no, the analytics have no idea what situational football is about. And that is what is mind blowing. So the criticism of, you know, them having, again, the audacity to run it three straight times on a drive, that which they did only once, by the way.
They only ran back to back plays in that one drive. They only ran back to back runs in that one drive. Never once throughout the rest of the game did they run on back to back plays.
And everybody's saying, well, geez, they should have. I'm already sick of this phrase from freaking Twitter. They just never let Russ cook. Well, okay. Basically, this entire game, they put it on Russ's shoulders, except for that one drive. And y'all are pissed?
Yeah. Outside that one drive.
I've listened to a couple podcasts, including the NFL Ringer show. Robert Mays, who's basically a guy that I've listened to many times, rip Pete for his coaching style. And he's like, and they just waited until the fourth quarter to let Russell do something. Well, that's factually completely incorrect.
Right.
Like, I mean, I understand being critical of different coaches if their style doesn't match yours, but at least have the facts right. And the facts are that outside of the second drive of the game, including the very first drive of the game, they were, quote, letting Russ cook. So that criticism for this game,
it doesn't work.
Needs to die.
It doesn't work. Yeah, that, I feel like narratives of the entire season are trying to be crammed into this one game. And while I think there are criticisms of Pete Carroll, there's criticisms of the Seahawks as a whole, I think we can talk about those, but sure. I don't think we need to try and fit them all into this one game because, like you said, I mean, as far as letting Russ cook, this was his game. Outside of those three Marshawn Lynch runs and that one drive, they ran the ball three other times in the entire first half with Marshawn, once to David Moore for 6 yards. Russell Wilson led the team in rushing in the entire first half with 2 runs for 16 yards. And then it was him throwing the ball, 13 attempts. He only completed it 6 times, though. The reason why he was only 6 of 13 in the first half is because as soon as he was dropping back, it was Za'Darius Smith pressuring him almost immediately. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to do with that. I mean, Dwayne Brown coming back from injury for, you know, being after knee surgery kept him out for the last 3 weeks. You had Phil Haynes in there playing at guard because Jamarco Jones went down. So now you're down to your third string left guard. Joey Hunt, a warrior in this game. Yes, he's your backup center. Maybe even you could call him your third string center if you wanted to say Ethan Posick is your backup. But dude had to tape up his finger that got dislocated and is back out there and playing like a warrior. So, you know, they have their two guys on the right side, but Russell was just under pressure that entire first half. And yeah, the Packers had 2 weeks to prepare for this game. They had fresh legs on defense.
Yeah, you make 1,000 good points there. And this kind of parlays a little bit into the idea of Pete's coaching style and people being upset that they don't just turn Russell loose every single game, quote unquote, let him off his leash. Another phrase I can't stand, like he's a dog or something. Stop it. Now, the thing with the coaching style here is you mentioned that him dropping back to pass early, he was under constant pressure. Look at him through the whole second half. What was Russ doing? Running for his catfishing life, taking shot after shot. Look at his jersey at the end of the game. It's basically a giant grass stain. And you get mad at Pete Carroll because he wants to run the ball early so that Russell doesn't take 1,000 freaking shots so that maybe you have him for a full season.
Yeah.
See, it would be great to just turn Russell loose the whole season and play backyard football all season long. It would be a lot of fun. But instead of having Russ for a 15-year career, you're looking at a Cam Newton type of career where 5 to 7 years later, his body has been exploded because the coaches decided to extort his athletic ability every year that they could to save their own skin. People look at running the ball and taking that pressure off of Russell as if he's trying to like limit him and that it's short-sighted and that it's somehow archaic. And the thing is all of y'all aren't getting the bigger picture. This is a long-term plan to be sure that Russell can be your quarterback for the next 10, 15 years. Look at the way that second half went. Do you think that's sustainable long-term? Because it's not.
And that third quarter was really the Seahawks. It was their best quarter, but it was because Russell Wilson was taking those shots, making plays happen. They get two touchdowns. They get within 28-17. They give up a 40-yard bomb to Devontae Adams, where he jukes Trey Flowers out of his shoes twice on the way to the end zone. Not a good look for Trey Flowers. And I talked a little bit about this post-game. But, oh yeah, Diggs was there too to give him a little help and couldn't make that stop. But, you know, that was one-on-one again with Flowers. And you know, the Packers looking for that matchup. They got it. I know there's probably going to be a lot of people that are going to give Trey Flowers a hard time after the season and say, oh, you got to draft a cornerback. You got to get one early to replace Flowers because he stinks now. Remember what we were saying about Shaquille Griffin at the end of last season and talking about, oh, what a terrible second season that Shaquille Griffin had. And then he's come back and he's had darn near a Pro Bowl season. So let's hold off on the Trey Flowers hate in the offseason. And let's see how he bounces back in year three.
Absolutely. I'm not ready to give up on Flowers at all. I think he had overall a decent season, and especially talking about kind of the tradition of sophomore slumps for young Seahawks corners. Like, I do believe that he will be better next year because that's been the trend of pretty much every young corner we've plugged into that spot, or, you know, either spot, the left or right corner, right? So I have a lot of faith in that going forward. I think one of the bigger issues for Trey in this season was the fact that the safety help was so inconsistent, and it was inconsistent because of injuries.
Yeah.
Whether it was McDougal, Diggs, or
Tedrick Thompson went down.
Yeah. Earlier in the season, and having to rely on guys like Lano Hill, who flat can't play. So it just, it's hard to put a lot of blame on him. And on top of all of that, if Trey Flowers is struggling with somebody like Devontae Adams, you need to roll coverage to Devontae Adams.
Yeah.
Have the linebacker on that side of, on that play, it would have been probably what, Barton, if he was in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, have him buzz out deep in a deep zone and have Diggs roll over the top. Like, that's what you saw the Titans do to Lamar in that Ravens game. They clogged up the middle for their tight ends. Like, they just buzzed their linebackers deep.
Yeah.
Ken Norton failed to adjust to that. And that's the biggest problem with this defense going forward. In my opinion, it plays way too conservatively. And all this soft coverage that the corners play and give up everything underneath, because the coaching staff is scared to death to get beat over the top. I'm tired of seeing that. I want some more aggressiveness on defense. That's where my biggest concern is regarding coaching going forward.
But then in this game, I mean, they got beat over the top. You had that 40-yard touchdown to Adams. You had
playing soft. So why even do it at that point?
Right. That's what I'm saying. You had the 32-yarder on 3rd and 8 in the fourth quarter. You had another pass to Jimmy Graham for 27 yards in the third quarter. You know, it's they were giving up deep plays, despite, you know, you could almost, you know, forgive them for being soft if they weren't giving up those huge bombs. But it was in this game that those bombs came to bite them. The Seahawks, you know, the time of possession in that third quarter, you know, they hold the ball 11 minutes. The Packers only have it for 3, but they do get the touchdown. And then again, they have a nice 4-minute drive, finish off with Marshawn Lynch's 4th touchdown of his return to Seattle. And they don't get the 2-point conversion, but still 28-23, 9 minutes left. And here you go. You're feeling like this is the position that's setting up. Now all you have to do, get a defensive stop, and, you know, the Seahawks could get the ball back and maybe make something happen here late in the game once again.
Yeah, so that was the drive before last. So they get it with 9 minutes.
Where the Packers got it with 9 minutes. And they do pick up that 1 3rd and 10 to Allison that you mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
And then on 3rd and 9, this play.
Takes the shotgun snap. Seattle rushes for Blitz. Yes. Is coming. They get to him. And it's Shaquille Griffin who gets there. Shaquille was the brothers Griffin met at Aaron Rodgers. And they buried him. And what a scene. And you can hear 12s in the stands cheering the twin brothers. I got to check to see if Shaquem, it is his first career sack. Way to go, youngster.
Shaquem Griffin gets his first career sack with just about 6 minutes left to play in the game. And at that point, it felt like, okay, we've had like our storybook moment. Shaquem Griffin gets his first sack. His brother's there with him. Russell Wilson's getting the ball back. He's scored, you know, three straight touchdowns, driving the ball in the second half. Here we go. Now's the time.
Yeah, it really did feel like all the momentum was in our corner. And watching that moment with the brothers Griffin, like, that was really fun. I mean, that was definitely one of the plays that got me out of the chair, and I was yelling at the TV with excitement.
Flexing. You know,
Yeah. There was a lot of, those sort of things, right? It was really fun. And you did feel like, okay, Russ is hot. Like, this is our time. This is what Russ does. You know, he loves these moments. This is what he lives for.
Yeah.
And he comes out on that drive, hits a couple passes.
Hits one. He hit the one to Tyler Lockett, and the very next play was the one that he threw right to Malik Turner, and it falls to the
ground. He hit a couple passes.
Yeah, it just and one the next one wasn't caught.
No, because as much as people want to bitch about the Jimmy Graham spot, the play calling as far as when did they finally let Russ off the leash and all that crap, the biggest play in the game to me that really hindered this offense was that one, that drop by Malik Turner. And some people might say, well, why are you drawing up a play for your fifth wide receiver? Well, every play has an option for three or four or five receivers, however many that go out in the route, right?
Right.
It's not like the play is drawn up specifically for Malik Turner. It's that the Packers chose on defense to take away the first, second, third option, leaving Malik Turner open. Okay. It's not like Schottenheimer was like, oh man, it's crunch time. How do I get Malik Turner the ball?
Right.
That wasn't the thought process when that play was called. He's just an option. And he dropped it.
Yeah, it's not like drawing up that Ricardo Lockett play down at the goal line. You know, that was there is plenty of time for the play to develop, and Malik Turner was the open guy.
Correct.
So they follow that up with a 5-yard pass to Jacob Hollister, and then Russell gets sacked on third down. I mentioned that I think there was a holding call that got missed on that particular play. But 4th and 11, and the Seahawks have all their timeouts. They're on their side of the field. 2-minute
warning.
You got the 2-minute warning.
Yes.
I don't think there's a coach in the entire NFL that goes for it with all those scenarios as is, with the 2-minute warning, all timeouts, and 2:41 left on the clock.
Well, there might be one. It might be Sean McDermott up in Buffalo, who went for it on a 4th and 27 for like no catfishing reason. That's the thing. It's like people are like, well, you got to go for it on 4th every time. Punting is stupid. Well, okay, I mean, you can say that, but there are definitely times where it works out disastrously.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's just throwing all your chips in the middle on one play, whereas Pete Carroll decided that with the 3 timeouts, plus the 2-minute warning, plus if Aaron Rodgers, heaven forbid, throws an incomplete pass, you have 4 or 5 stoppages of the clock. Parlay that with the idea that the defense had played pretty well in the second half, giving up only the 1 score. And with Pete Carroll's nature, they definitely are going to make the decision to punt the ball there. And it's the right decision. I didn't think about it for half a second. You punt the ball there. And you saw Aaron Rodgers had to make 2 spectacular throws on 3rd down to make that happen, to close out the game.
Yeah, and you know, if he doesn't make one of those throws, I think he's getting some criticism for going for that 2nd down pass on 2nd and 8 and giving the Seahawks extra time. So, you know, it's a bummer that, you know, he hits Davante Adams for that 32-yard pass on 3rd and 8. You know, Adams lined up on Ugo Amadi, Lano Hill way late over the top to try and give him any kind of help. I think we've covered how we both feel about Lano Hill so far. And then, Jimmy Graham, the one call that we've been talking about. And it's kind of the one moment that I think is going to stick in our minds because of the yellow line on the field and the photo that you see circulating on social media. I think if you do go back and you look at the different angles, the line was a little bit ahead of where the actual 1st down was. Was it still a couple inches short? I would like to think so, and I'd like to see the Seahawks have to try and defend that fourth down play. Would they have done it?
Right.
I don't know. It probably would have been likely. I would have liked to see him come down to that, though.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Jimmy Graham thing real quick, and then let's go back to Ugo in his play on Adams there.
Okay.
Look, as far as the Jimmy Graham play is concerned, if I'm an official, and I've watched a lot of football in my lifetime, every time you see a play end up that close with the receiver, with his forward progress going forward as he's tackled, he gets the first down every time. He just does. And that's how it was going to be. And you're never going to overturn it.
Did they even bring out the sticks to measure?
I don't recall.
I don't think they did.
Maybe they didn't. I mean, I just know that the second that Jimmy went down, I was like, oh, that's a first down.
Right.
It was a first down. Like, whether or not technically it was by a half an inch or whatever, the way the game is called, that's going to be a first down every time. Quit whining about it. Like, I know you circulated that picture too, and it bothers me because it's whiny, and I don't like it. Now, secondly, let's say it was even short.
Okay.
And they go for it on fourth down because they would have.
Right.
There is no doubt in anybody's mind. That's a place you go for it on fourth down. That, because it actually makes sense. They weren't stopping that. They hadn't stopped anything short all night.
Yeah.
The game was over one way or the other after Adams caught the pass previous, on the previous set of downs. So, like, really, at the end of the day, that stuff, the Jimmy Graham stuff, stop it. Don't be a crybaby ass fan. Don't. It makes us look dumb.
I am circulating that photo because the Packers have had all this time to circulate the quote unquote fail Mary for years and years and years and perpetuate that myth. Yeah.
How crybaby ass was that? How terrible was that as Packers fans that they continued to latch on to that, right? And how pathetic did it look? Don't stoop to their level, bro. Don't.
It's another moment in Seahawks Packers history. And it's kind of fun now that to when we can look for those and hold on to them.
I don't know. I honestly, in my heart of hearts, believe the fail Mary was the right call, according to the rule. Honestly, in my heart of hearts, think Jimmy Graham got a first down there.
Yeah.
And even if he didn't, it wouldn't have freaking mattered.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the play that did
And when
matter.
Matt Hasselbeck said that we want the ball and we're going to score, I believed him in that moment.
I did too. And the thing is he might have forgot he was on the Seahawks for half a second, thought he was still back on the Packers. And honestly, then what he said came true. He was going to take the ball and then they were going to score. It just happened to be not the team he was on anymore. Yeah,
there was a score because Alex Bannister ran the wrong route. But, we can hold on to these things for as long as we want.
Or not.
Or not.
I'm not one of those people that do that. But let's talk about Amadi on Adams in that big third down catch over the shoulder. And look, at first I thought that Amadi just played with the wrong leverage. And after looking at it, I mean, it's a Lano Hill problem, man. I know that Amadi's not a stupid player, even though he's a rookie. One of his best attributes is that he is a very intelligent football player and plays with good technique. That's not how he usually gets beat. He usually gets beat because of athleticism. That wasn't the case. He played with inside leverage. Adam takes it to the outside. And Lano Hill was out there picking his nose or something. I don't know what he was doing. But there was no help over the top.
Yeah.
And I think that Amadi was absolutely expecting it. And so that's frustrating.
I mean, it was the one catch that Amadi gave up the entire day. So
he's played so well down the stretch, especially for a rookie.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe I don't know what the communication issues were between Flowers and Amadi on that first Devontae Adams touchdown. I don't know. In the stat sheet, it doesn't go down as Amadi touchdown for that the first Devontae Adams touchdown. But
yeah, I think that's on Ken Norton, right?
Probably. I don't know.
Yeah, that one. I mean, this game ended up like every other game this season and almost every other prior season. And I mean, we're in it. Like, we finished 11-5, had a playoff win, and went down swinging to the Packers in legendary Lambeau Field. I mean, it was a great season. Not every season is going to end with a chip or a trip to the Super Bowl even. That is so rare. I know everybody looks at the Patriots and they kind of feel like their team should be just like the Patriots, and they're every single year. Like, I don't know. Do people forget what it was like to be a Seahawks fan for, you know, years and years prior to Pete Carroll? And I mean, even years between Noel and Holmgren. Like, do you not remember the Scott Erickson era? Like, it's so hard to consistently have very good seasons. I mean, I'm just so grateful for this year. It was a roller coaster of a ride with a roster that, going into it, I went back and listened to our preseason expectations.
Yeah.
I said 12-4.
Uh-huh.
You said 11-5.
I win.
Okay. And with that said, and I said privately to other people, you know, throughout the season, I was like, yeah, you know, 12-4, first round, you know, second round playoff exit is kind of the ceiling for this team.
Yeah.
And that's as a couple of homers. Okay. that's our expectations as a couple of giant homers. And you look at the expectations of the entire country and the rest of the National Football League, people didn't even think we were going to be third in our division.
Yeah.
Like, and people wring their hands over the season like it's some lost season for Russ. I mean, the team is coming to the end of a rebuild. I mean, one more offseason and it's going to be lit. I appreciate what Pete did with this team this year. I appreciate the effort from the players and guys like Clowney, you know, playing through injury. It was a magical ride, and I had fun.
Wait, rebuilding season? No, you can only have one season, and you can't call it rebuilding. You have to call it retooling, because that's what they did last year.
Reloading, yeah.
And they made it to the playoffs anyway. And so this was supposed—they were supposed to be rebuilt by now. And except, I guess you could point to injuries too. But you know, you brought up the playoff thing, and maybe being a little bit spoiled as Seahawks fans, and we are spoiled. Go back to 2005. That was the year of the last Super Bowl. That was also the start of an amazing run of being in the divisional round of the playoffs. Mm-hmm. The Seahawks made it to the divisional round 2005 through 2007. You know, mm-hmm. they both went out in the division round in 06 and 07. So didn't make the playoffs in 8 and 9. You know, Holmgren's final year, injuries, Mora's terrible year, Mora. Then Pete Carroll comes to the team, takes us to the divisional round with a 7 and 9 football team. They missed the playoffs in 2011. And now made the divisional round in 2012, Super Bowl 2013, Super Bowl 2014, divisional round in 2015, divisional round in 2016. They miss in 17 because of a Blair Walsh, you know, experiment. And they missed the playoffs on their retooling. They missed the divisional round in their retooling year in 2018, and they make it to the divisional round in 2019. Only 8 teams in the entire NFL make it to the divisional round. And I pointed out 4-5 years since 2005 that the Seahawks haven't been a part of the divisional round.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's we're pretty spoiled. Awesome. It's really awesome.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, do we not remember the lean years? I said Scott Erickson earlier, and that's a work colleague of my dad's, and I do this every time I think of Dennis Erickson.
Dennis Erickson, yeah.
Yeah, I realized it about halfway through when you were just describing our divisional round success over the last decade or so. And look, don't be a Patriot fan. Everybody hates Patriot fans. You want to know why? They're up 21-3 in a game. They're like, oh, we're just not up enough. They don't go to the Super Bowl. Oh, it's a lost season. Like, those fans are insufferable. Like, the idea that they don't enjoy the ride ever. And look, there's maybe now's the time to kind of get a little bit into the Pete Carroll thing.
Yeah.
In Seahawks Twitter. Because look, it's not like this year was 6-10 and a complete dumpster fire. This isn't Mike McCarthy failing to make the playoff year after year after year. This isn't Jason Garrett standing on the sidelines clapping his brains out. This isn't Doug Peterson even, you know, struggling after winning the Super Bowl mightily. This isn't even Sean McVay, who didn't even make the playoffs this year after the year before being anointed the golden boy of the entire NFL. This was a good year. Last year was a good year. The year before that was a winning season. It missed the playoffs by one game. What are you crying about? Like, I understand if you're frustrated with the team in terms of the aesthetic of it. Yeah. Because what I feel like this Seahawks Twitter people, because the people that are prominent on there, I don't know if you agree with this, but to me, they tend to be stat nerds and analytic people. And they want it to, they want everybody to go for it on fourth every time, throw the ball every single time. Every time you run the ball is a wasted down. And they don't understand football. They understand math really well. And that's great. But of all the professional sports, the one that math influences the least is football. This isn't the NBA. So I feel like the big discussion comes down to, if you don't enjoy defense, running the ball, smash mouth football, that sort of football ethos, if you're a Andy Reid, spread it out, that game between the Chiefs and the Rams 2 years ago, where there was never a lick of defense played and people declared it the greatest game ever played. If that's the type of football you enjoy, then Pete Carroll, you're going to hate Pete Carroll. And I think that's what it boils down to. Because at the end of the day, you can't argue with the final product. This team overachieved this year, especially with the injuries going down the stretch.
Well, and I wonder too, it's, and I don't think it's a very big portion of Seahawks Twitter, Adam. I think it gets a rap because there are some vocal people in terms of the criticisms of Pete Carroll. And I think there's valid criticisms too. I think Pete Carroll and time management, he's had time management issues. He's had timeout management issues. Yeah, that's fine to be critical of that. But I don't know if you're going to find, I mean, go find me the best coach at time management and timeout issues, and tell me if they're better at all the other things that Pete Carroll does. Like, coaches are going to have strengths and weaknesses. That's one of Pete Carroll's weaknesses. Going for it more on fourth down. I think that there are some situations where Pete Carroll, he could have gone for it more on fourth down. And okay, it's frustrating and maybe they can change a little bit, but I went and looked at some of the other teams and their fourth down attempts this season. You look at the playoff teams. Seahawks went for it more on fourth down than the Kansas City Chiefs, who went for it just 10 times. The Seahawks went for it 14 times on fourth down this past season. So that's four more than the Chiefs, who had 10. Mm-hmm. Two more than the 49ers, who had 12. More than the Saints by one, and more than the Rams by one. Other playoff teams that went for it about the same, Titans, Packers, both 14. Vikings, 15, about the same. The one team that went for it a ton, that was, two teams, the Eagles with 24 and the Ravens with 24.
Okay.
The Eagles were only successful 8 times, so 33%, terrible. Mm-hmm. And the Ravens were the most successful with 17. So
until the playoffs came and then they were 0% successful.
Right. And that was a big factor in why they lost that game. And you know, credit to the Titans for holding up in those situations. And I feel like they're a darling now because they're a fun team to watch. And yeah, they run the football and it's Derrick Henry, run you over. It's physical football. And the 49ers, they run the crap out of the ball.
The Ravens have, quote unquote, according to Robert Mays, revolutionized football with their running attack, which is basically the wishbone. Okay. It's basically the wishbone with a little option thrown in.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious to me that all of these people that talk about the inefficiency of running the football absolutely love the hell out of the Ravens offense when they run the hell out of the football. They love the hell out of Kyle Shanahan's offense when they are the number one team rushing the football. Like, what's it going to be, guys? You have to choose. You can't just be excited about running the football when it works and hating it when it doesn't. Like, right. You have to be consistent in one philosophy or another to have any success whatsoever. And Pete Carroll has chosen that he enjoys running the football. Now, people say it's archaic and that it's something that can't work long term. When is Pete Carroll going to get into the 21st century, right? Uh-huh. Well, what is the 21st century right now in terms of exotic football or the most effective football? Well, let me see. The Titans are a run first team, right? The Packers are driven by their run game right now. right? The 49ers are one of the best rushing teams in football, right? And the only team that's not run first in mentality is the Chiefs in the Final Four. So three out of the four last teams standing are predominantly running teams. The Rams go to the Super Bowl last year, and nobody gives any credit to it for predominantly being a running football team.
Right.
See, that's the thing. It is 21st century football. It's also, you know, 1930s football. The reason Pete Carroll likes to play this way is because he's been around the game for 500 years, and he knows that year in and year out, if you play great defense, run the shit out of the football, and have a quarterback that can make big plays, you have a chance to win the title every single year. And it's the most consistent way to win football games. And you can hate on it all you want and cry about how you wish that they let Russell throw more. But would you rather be as consistent as we have been? And let's not give Pete Carroll a bunch of credit for the last 10 years. Let's just take the last three. All winning seasons, two playoff appearances, and a playoff win this year. So I'm not even hanging the hat back on the old LOB days, right?
Yeah.
And being like, well, you get a lifetime pass for being successful. That's successful seasons 3 years in a row. Ask Sean McVay how his last season went. Watch Cliff Kingsbury next year. Watch Mike Shanahan next year. All these revolutionary coaches. Doug Peterson after winning the Super Bowl. How'd that buff out for him the next year? So I would take the consistency of this philosophy over the get some young gun like Eric Bieniemy to come in and maybe be awesome for a year until the league catches up with you the next and smacks you the hell back down.
We could find some teams that do it sustainably in terms of throwing the football, like the way that Andy Reid does it with Patrick Mahomes, who might just be the best quarterback in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And then you hope that, you know, his shoulder doesn't fall off from throwing it 50 times a game, because you can only throw it 50 times a game so much. Mm-hmm. And I look at just team construction too. When you pay your top quarterback in the league, top quarterback money, you're playing at a little bit of a disadvantage compared to other teams. Because look at the 49ers. Yes, they are among the top teams paying Jimmy Garoppolo. I think he's in the top 10 or so in terms of percentage. But look at their defensive line and five first round draft picks that none of them they're having to pay yet. Now that's going to change real soon.
Yeah. And to that point, what did they have to suffer through to get those top picks for 5 years in a row?
They lost year after year after year from 2014
Jim Tomsula,
on.
Chip Kelly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to go down that route, Seahawk fan?
I mean, it would make tickets that much cheaper, I think, to CenturyLink for those who want to go. I mean, the pretty empty stadiums down there in Santa Clara for years and years and years. But yes, mm-hmm. that's what they had to go through. Not just losing seasons, but the worst seasons. So they got a top 1, 2, 3 draft pick. And I don't think I'm willing to go through that. I like going to the playoffs and having a chance every single year because, they might not get it every year, but we've had more of a chance over the last 5 years, you know, than the 49ers have to make it to the Super Bowl.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the factors that go into teams making the Super Bowl, right? And I think the number one factor is having a clutch, consistent quarterback, right? I think we can all agree on that. I think the second biggest factor in going to the Super Bowl for a team is by far health, which is a bit of a crapshoot. And maybe it is and maybe it isn't. Like our strength and conditioning coach, the dude that came from USC, they were stoked to see him leave
right
last year. And you see the team fall apart after, you know, beginning 10-2, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where are all these Pete Carroll criticisms as well when we were 10-2? Like, where were those people?
Yeah.
They were having a hell of a time, you know, being within an eighth of an inch of winning the division and being a 2 seed. Like, that's how close it is. And health is such a huge deciding factor going down the stretch. And that's usually, it's one of the biggest defining things. And look at the Niners. I mean, they got healthy towards the end of the year rather than becoming more injured.
Jimmy G did not get hurt this year. He made it.
So, he made it. I needed to see it once. I've seen it now.
Now
I believe he can do it.
Now he can, now you know. But yeah, that's what I was trying to get at too, is that when you're paying your top quarterback in the league, it reduces that margin of error, because you brought up injuries. That's one facet of it. You got to hit on your draft picks. That's another facet of it. You got to hit on your free agents. And you can look at injuries, you can look at draft picks, you can look at free agents, and you can see where there were misses in those areas, and they were still able to get to the point they did. But, you know, hit on a couple more draft picks early on that are able to contribute during the season. Don't get as many injuries. Hit on some of the free agents that you bring in. Don't get suspensions late in the season like Josh Gordon and Al Woods. And maybe things turned out a little bit differently, but it is because you're paying your quarterback, and I'm fine with paying the best quarterback in the league, top quarterback money. That's going to happen, and it's going to help get us to the point where we are, but it is going to reduce that margin of error, I think.
Oh, absolutely. It puts a lot more emphasis, especially on the draft, right? And give John Schneider 1,000,000% credit for hitting on as many guys as he does. Like, you know, you're just saying, well, hit on more draft picks. Well, cool. Like, you can only be so much of a Houdini, right? I mean,
the last 20 few drafts have been pretty good, too.
They've been pretty good. And look, did LJ Collier come in and help this year? No, he didn't. Am I ready to write him off? Absolutely not. Let's see what happens next year. He could be a huge force for us next year. And then also going into this draft, draft on the line, whether that's offense or defense, with every catfishing pick. Everyone sign every free agent you can, and then we'll sort it out from there, whoever the best players are. That's where all these games are won, are in the trenches. Everybody gets all caught up with skill position players, and that's not where it's at. And you've seen it happen here in the playoffs. The Titans pushed the Ravens around. Mm-hmm. The Niners brutalized the Vikings and just bullied them. And honestly, between Fletcher Cox the last game and the Smith brothers in this game, we got pushed around.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get pushed around.
Well, the Seahawks, you brought up the draft, but free agency too. When you look at the number of starters on the offensive line and on the defensive line who are free agents this year, they're either going to have to build it through free agency or the draft, because some of these names I look at and I don't necessarily want to bring them back. Some of them they may bring back anyway, but look at the offensive line.
Okay.
George Fant, free agent this year.
Mm-hmm.
Jermaine Ifedi, free agent.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Iupati and Joey Hunt's a free agent too.
Mm-hmm.
Four of those guys who have all played starting snaps on your offensive line.
Sure. So this goes a little bit to how the team feels about Justin Britt next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, honestly, like Joey Hunt, I think we can all agree is not the long-term answer at center. He's a great backup piece. And depending on what he's demanding for salary, cool, bring him back. Now, Ifedi, he'll probably get paid by somebody.
He was the most healthy offensive lineman. Like looking down the stats, I was looking at pressure numbers and he is at the top. And then I said, oh, yeah, well, he's also played more than any offensive lineman did this entire season.
Yeah, he also has the most effing Ifedi moments.
Right.
You know, like I could.
Do you think that goes away with experience, though? Like, at what point? At what point does it happen? I don't know.
I mean, I guess maybe it was about this time for Breno that he put it together.
Yeah.
Like it was his last year with the Seahawks. But I feel like you don't pay Ifedi. As far as Iupati goes, depends on the salary. I mean, with his injury history over the last few years, that's fine. It's tough to bank on him. And then, let's see, who else? Fant, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the league clamoring to go out and give a sixth offensive lineman a bunch of money. So those are all guys that I think are easily re-signable.
Yeah.
You know, as far as going forward, you mentioned free agency being a big deal, but paying Russell Wilson the type of money that you are, you can't really bank on building things through free agency unless you can find some market inefficiencies and some bargains like they did with Michael Bennett years ago.
And I think it's out there. I think you could argue that the Packers found an inefficiency at defensive line last year when they signed Preston Smith and Za'Darius Smith in the offseason.
Yeah. Yeah.
That worked out pretty well for them. Now, I don't know if those same guys are out there this offseason. That's probably something that you and I are going to be looking at as we go into the offseason. But on the defensive line for the Seahawks, you got four guys. again, starting snaps, you have Clowney, you have Al Woods, you have Jaron Reed, and Ziggy Ansah, all four of those guys free agents, and another guy who plays pretty close to the line of scrimmage, you got Michael Kendricks, who's a free agent.
Sure. So out of those guys, who are you interested in seeing coming back, and who would you wave out the door?
Clowney is the number one by the biggest margin, and maybe the closest number two, but it's a far, far, far closest down on the priority list is Jaron Reed. And Al Woods, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of market for him that you can't bring him back.
No, I don't think you're going to be bringing Al Woods back. I mean, he proved that he can't be trusted to be there down the stretch. He would have been a huge difference maker for us going down the stretch, having that run clogging D-tackle. That was a bigger loss than I think anybody has given any thought to. That was a pretty catastrophic one. As far as Clowney, yes, you just give him the money, back the truck up, whatever it is. That's fine. I believe in paying DNs with that sort of talent, the type of money that they deserve. Now, I don't pay D tackles that kind of money, but DNs I do.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as Jaron Reed goes, this season for him might be the biggest blessing ever for us as Seahawks fans. Having been suspended for a large chunk of the year and then coming back and not really being as dominant as he was the year before, where you probably would have to give him top tier money. Now maybe you get him on a mid-tier contract or a short-term cheap contract, so like a prove-it year.
Yeah.
And yes, I would be interested in that. As far as Kendricks goes, I would be willing to see him walk. I think that's the position group that I believe you talked about it on the Field Goals podcast with, was it with Alistair?
Yeah.
And you guys talked about speed at the linebacking position, and some people seem to think that we have really fast linebackers right now. We don't. Like Bobby's fairly fast, but he's not a speedster at this point in his career. And KJ never was a speedster, and he has definitely lost a step. Now, with his brains and all that, he is still an amazing player. And I'm not saying get rid of KJ, but maybe move him to strong side and bring in a speedster, a young guy at weak side.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a huge spot to upgrade. So maybe Kendricks could walk away.
Yeah, I'd be okay with Kendricks walking away, and he may not be one of those players that there's a huge market for either. So they have those guys. You know, you have some of your backups like Quentin Jefferson, Brandon Jackson also played on the defensive line. So they do have a lot of free agents, and those guys, you know, we'll see. I think Quentin Jefferson of those guys, probably he probably gets around $5 or $6 million a year and is probably someone who would go somewhere else if that were the case. I don't see the Seahawks maybe keeping him at that kind of price tag, especially having Rasheem Green coming back next year, LJ Collier coming back next year. So, and then whatever they decide to build through for the draft. But yeah, they're going to have some choices to make, especially on the lines though.
Yeah, which is a little scary in some ways, because again, that's where football games are won and lost for the most part. We didn't talk about Ziggy at all. I think everybody's in agreement that that just didn't work.
He could come back if it's like a Deion Jordan situation. You know, maybe. He came here and kind of on that prove it deal.
Yeah.
He didn't prove it. And then they still kept him around at a lower salary for the next couple of years just to see if he might bounce back. That might be the position Ansah's in.
It might be. And, you know, we'll look around the league this offseason. We got a long time to do it and see what guys could potentially be available. But I think pretty much everybody's in agreement as regarding the defense that, you know, D-line, especially the interior, is a huge problem right now. And everybody wants Clowney back. Now, the question becomes, does Clowney want to come back? I mean, he's stated openly after this last game, he has no intention of playing for a team that he doesn't view as a legit Super Bowl contender.
Right.
Does he view the Seattle Seahawks as a legit Super Bowl contender?
I would think, based on the history that we just went over, that he would think so. But you never know. You saw Jaron Reed talk about how he wants respect. Respect equals money. And, you know, Jadeveon Clowney, he wants respect too. He wants all the respect. So, yeah, he could want to go to a contender, but he could also go to a contender that gives him the most respect.
True. But the good news is with the cap situation that we have going into next year, that paying somebody like Clowney is totally an option. It really is. I mean, you spoke a little bit about paying Russ, you know, top tier money, but we've all kind of looked at this upcoming offseason as being one that John Schneider is going to have a little bit of money to play with some of the old LOB money coming off the books and that sort of thing. And it, he's done a good job of clearing out cap space.
Yeah, the only the biggest amount of dead cap money that the Seahawks have going into 2020 is from Gary Jennings, your fourth round draft pick who missed.
Right.
That's right. And that's $500,000.
Somehow that's not a huge number.
In terms of salary cap spending, that's not a huge number.
It's not.
In terms of lifetime wealth money that I think any of us would have enjoy.
Well, that's never, yes. Yeah. But in terms of cap number, no, that is not a big number whatsoever.
No, and their estimated cap space at $68.5 million right now.
Yeah. That's a nice chunk of change.
Even if you give 20 of that to Clowney.
Yes.
And maybe Chris Carson going into his last year, maybe you sign him a little bit early to make that work for a couple more years. I don't know.
I can't. And I love me some Chris Carson.
For the right price. For the right price, Adam.
It would have to be pretty cheap because I'm having a hard time relying on him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little of that Jimmy G thing that we talked about earlier. Like, complete a season. Show me that it's possible.
Right.
I haven't seen it yet.
You know who's going to be a free agent this year?
Marshawn.
Yeah, he is going to be a free agent this year. I'd like to see him come back and be the third down dude.
You know, I thought a lot about that after we chatted about that last night, and I don't. I mean, I love the idea in the sense of him being the short yardage guy and getting all the touchdowns and all that. That'd be fun because it's Marshawn, right?
Yeah.
He's a good dude. But we just saw this year, you can't have enough quality backs on your roster.
Right.
And I think it's been kind of showing that, you know, Marshawn's at a point in his career where you can't lean on him to be the guy. And maybe that's a result of the entire offensive line being injured for the most part. I don't know. But it just didn't seem to be like he could be your third option.
Yeah. Well, okay. Maybe he can be the fifth option. He's not on your roster, but you can call him when you need him, just like you did this year. He can be in reserve.
Yeah. Why not? I think that works good for him, too.
It was fun. And, you know, we talked about it going into the postseason that we were looking to have some fun because we saw it with the injury situation that I think that, you know, realistically, if you were to say, yeah, the Seahawks are going to the Super Bowl. I mean, it wasn't as clear as day as that was going to happen, especially when you looked at the defense and the injuries. And so to have some fun, to have the Marshawn Lynch moments, to have the Griffin brothers moment in this last game. To have some Marshawn Lynch press conferences to close out the season. It's been fun.
It's all been very fun. And I think you talked about everybody's mindset going into this season. Which one of us is surprised that it came down to the defense not being able to get a stop?
Yeah, you know what? And I think that does take us back to some of the Pete Carroll criticisms. And I think maybe the most valid criticism is that he's a defensive coach, and the defense was not good this year. On the same token, if you were to go out and get another coach, who are you going to get that you could trust to rebuild this defense or improve this defense?
Mm-hmm.
I think having Pete Carroll puts him in a pretty good position to say we can count on him to improve the defense because of what he's done in the past.
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, a lot of people are really angry with him about playing base all year instead of a more nickel. And there might be something to that. I also think that he looked at that defensive roster and was like, who are my most talented guys? And clearly, Wags, KJ, and Kendricks were three of the more talented dudes on your defensive roster. And I think in his mindset, it was, I might as well get my best guys out there rather than guys that are lesser. So, I mean, you look at this defense and it has regressed every year over the last 3 years, and that is a valid criticism. But also think about what's happened over the last 3 years. Basically, we've lost the entire LOB over the last 3 years. I mean, we had Earl on the roster last year.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that. This is the first year that we haven't had any of them.
That's true. Yeah, it's weird to think. I mean, we had Earl for what, 4 games last year before he got hurt.
But. Understood. But with that said, there has been a lessening of talent coming into the defensive side of the ball, then an influx of talent.
Yeah.
And that points a little to why the defense has struggled. Now, I think through a savvy draft and probably two solid free agent signings outside of Clowney on the defensive line, and now we're cooking. I mean, it does feel like that is something that they can rebound from, because I look at the secondary and I know people are killing the secondary this year, but a full season of Diggs and McDougal and just Lano Hill being off the roster. Right. You combine that with Shaq and what I believe will be a bounce back year for Trey and Amadi showing
Amadi in his second year, Blair in his second year.
Yes, there's a lot of talent there. So I feel good about the secondary. Obviously, the linebackers were set. And it's just a couple pieces on the D line, I think, makes a difference from being second in the division to a first round bye, maybe in one seed.
And I don't know if it's a criticism for Coach Carroll or maybe more of a criticism for Ken Norton, but on back-to-back seasons now, we get to the end of the year. And what were we saying at the end of last year? You know, why was Puna Ford not on the field more? Now we're saying, why was Ugo Amadi not on the field more? Why was Marquise Blair not out on the field more? And he didn't make it into the playoff game
because
he got hurt
Keem
in the middle of the
week. Why was Keem not on the field more?
Why was Keem not on the field more? But he's at least had a couple years now on the roster. I think that Ken Norton Jr. might be a coach who's reluctant to play young players. And while Pete Carroll hasn't been that way in the past, I think Coach Norton might be that way.
Yeah, it does feel that way, right? I mean, there was that time with all the young players of the LOB coming up where Pete talked up the idea of playing young guys because of his experience at USC and the way that you have to do that in college football to compete. And it does feel like a reluctance now. And I doubt that comes from Pete. Doesn't seem like it.
I don't think Pete's changed in his mindset in that regard.
Right.
Which would leads me to Coach Norton. So, because I do think that he's the type of old school coach that would have that type of mindset.
Right.
And I look at, you know, some of the other criticisms of Ken Norton Jr. And I know I saw Mookie Alexander on Field Goals put out the two worst last years of Seahawks defense were now under Coach Norton, which, you know, I think it could be the fact that the LOB was moving on. It could be partly due to the way Coach Norton's style is, but 14th in DVOA last year, 18th this year. And, you know, DVOA tends to take out the strength of schedule type argument because it accounts for that in terms of how they do the rankings. But, mm-hmm. you know, looking at the stats that he pulled out, Seahawks defense, 31st in punts per drive, 32nd in third downs forced, 32nd in early down first downs, 26th in red zone defense, 28th in pressure rate, 29th in yards after the catch allowed. Oh, that goes to the secondary. 29th in tackles for a loss in passing situations, 29th in missed tackles, 26th in run defense by DVOA.
Okay, let's break that down to pass defense and run defense real quick. You talked about the secondary being 29th in the league at run after the catch. Well, that to me feels like a deceiving stat, and it's in this way. We all know that the secondary and the pass rush are intrinsically linked, right? I mean, you kind of need one and the other to work hand in glove to have a great pass defense. Now, if you're a decent secondary with decent talent, like you can kind of stick with guys for 2, maybe 3 seconds. But when you have a defensive line that can't get home at all and doesn't ever get any pressure, then you're trying to stick with a dude forever. Eventually they're going to break free. And the longer you're trying to cover, the more separation they're going to finally be able to find. And then at that point, when they do catch the ball, you're kind of in a hopeless position.
Yeah.
So I think that's difficult to blame on the secondary. I mean, we all thought about it coming into this year. Even before the Clowney trade, where's the pass rush going to come from? We were all very nervous about that. And honestly, it never showed up. It finally did against the Niners, I guess, the first go around when everybody was there and everybody was healthy. And then it all blew up.
Yeah, pass rush is going to be the issue that they're going to have to fix. And, you know, I hate doing the 2012 comparisons because I feel like we've done plenty of 2012 comparisons. But pass rush was the issue in 2012.
Yeah.
And I think we knew going into this season that it was still, even in the offseason, it didn't feel like they quite addressed it enough. But they had Russell Wilson to resign, too, and Bobby Wagner.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult to patch all the holes in a roster every single offseason because it turns out there's 31 other teams that are vying for all that talent out there as well. It's just hard to do. And especially when you're consistently successful. You don't get the benefit of drafting, you know, the top three players 5 years in a row. But then again, you don't have to suffer through, you know, Nick Mullins for a year. Pick your poison, I guess. But at the end of the day, I feel good about the idea going into next year, where we can go. And now it's in John Schneider's hands a little bit. And if there's one thing I know for sure, I will lay down on the line and say after this year, I absolutely want Pete Carroll to be the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks next year with zero doubt in my mind. And there shouldn't be in yours either.
And I don't think that's going out on a big limb. And I did see a poll that somebody put out on Seahawks Twitter, and it was going about 85% in favor of bringing Pete Carroll back to 15% of fire Pete Carroll. So it's a pretty small minority, but maybe a growing minority that we just have to, we have to consider that it's there and recognize that, yes, there are some criticisms and the fact that Pete Carroll put us all under a lot of stress this year.
Well, sure. And it, again, it's a roster in transition.
All right, Adam. Well, with that, what do you say we get to the second half of the show? Getting into the second half of the show, and before welcoming some new members of the flock, wanted to take a look at some Marshawn Lynch statistics from the postseason. Marshawn finishes tied at number 4 for all-time postseason touchdown leaders among running backs behind Emmitt Smith, Franco Harris, Thurman Thomas, and he's tied with John Riggins and Terrell Davis with 12. So, hey, Marshawn Lynch gets to 12 postseason touchdowns.
Yeah, that's awesome. If he doesn't end up in the Hall of Fame, I will be livid.
He has to make it. And, you know, I guess while we're talking, I do want to talk about the Hall of Fame because there was something that made me livid this week. But no. I do think that I think Marshawn will make it just being on that list. Marcus Allen, the other guy with 11, and really in the among the only guys who have 10 or more touchdowns, that all of them are in the Hall of Fame, except I don't think LeGarrette Blount is going to get there, but he was the other guy who's in this list of guys who have 10 or more touchdowns in the postseason.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, with the Blount thing, I mean, that's a guy that didn't necessarily have an amazing career throughout the regular seasons as well.
But he played for Philly, played for the Patriots, and he was the guy that they handed off to on the goal line.
Right.
And if you look at the number of yards, too, of postseason yards, Marshawn, he didn't quite get enough to get 1,000 yards, but you know, you look at the top 10 guys in terms of the most 100 yard rushing games. Emmitt Smith and Terrell Davis are the top two with, I think, 7, and then Marshawn has 6, and he's tied with Thurman Thomas and John Riggins. And if you look at the yardage, the top 10. Every single one of these guys with Marshawn Lynch is in the Hall of Fame, except for Chuck Foreman, who should be in the Hall of Fame.
I'll go with you on that one. I don't have a strong opinion.
I don't want to step on your do better if this is your do better, but one thing that did infuriate me this weekend is seeing the two TV coaches. I think Jimmy Johnson should get in the Hall of Fame. That was kind of a cool moment on TV.
Sure.
But Bill Cowher getting in ahead of Mike Holmgren, because I think they only do two, and they did Jimmy Johnson and Bill Cowher. And for Mike Holmgren to not get in the Hall of Fame before Bill Cowher,
right?
I think that's messed up.
Well, I mean, you understand why that happened, right?
Because he's a TV coach?
Yeah, I mean, because Mike isn't a TV coach. And so they couldn't have, you know, Andre the Giant's like illegitimate stepbrother come out and announce to the world that the TV coach was ready to have some fake tears and be announced as a Hall of Famer. So... They just couldn't do it with Mike. So then they were like, oh, well, we can do that with Bill.
Guess we'll do it with Bill. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know Raiders fans are bent because Tom Flores didn't get in, which as a Seahawks fan, that doesn't upset me. But I think as a Raiders fan, you probably look at that and say Tom Flores should be in.
I bet they do. Yeah, I bet they do. I guess I've never thought of Tom Flores as a Hall of Fame type coach. I mean, he's obviously, you know, won some chips and, you know, quality coach and all that. But I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
he kind of felt like a guy.
Well, he was the guy who took over for John Madden, right?
Yeah.
And he did win Super Bowls. And, you know, he did go on to do some things.
Yeah. I mean, sure. I think the Big Show had a much larger impact on the league, not just in terms of winning But in terms of his coaching tree that has spread over the league, I mean, I don't look at Tom Flores as having like some sort of huge influence on the league in that regard. I mean,
well, that's why Holmgren should get in, is because that influence, and not just in terms of his coaching tree, but look at the quarterbacks that he coached in San Francisco when he was an assistant for Bill Walsh.
Yep.
And Steve Young, and gosh, I mean,
Joe Montana. Talk about the quarterbacks that he pumped out in Green Bay, whether that was Brett Favre, whether that was Mark Brunell.
Yeah.
There were guys that came out.
Matt Hasselbeck.
Matt Hasselbeck.
I think he was a late round guy too, and you know, went on to have a ton of success in the league.
Ton of success. I mean, he was second best quarterback we've ever had. Yeah. I would say he had more than a ton.
More than a ton?
Yeah.
I thought a ton was pretty good.
Yeah, you know.
Two tons.
Yeah, Matt drafted in the sixth round. You're right.
Just like Tom Brady. I know Tom Brady was drafted in the sixth round because I hear that every single time.
I was going to say, they're not going to let you forget. Yeah, they're not going to let you forget.
No. Well, we don't want to forget about our new members of the flock who came in over the last couple of weeks. And we'll start off with a raise. Bam McDonald gave us a raise to $5. So thanks to Bam.
That's awesome, dude. Appreciate that a ton, especially following a loss. It's hard for people to be excited about Seahawks things right now, I think.
Well, I think this one, I don't think we have had any new raises since the loss, but this came in before. And so I think this was the start of the new year type of donation. So we appreciate that. We also appreciate Z-Chun Ko coming in at 1212 with a one-time donation. Seahawkerspodcast.com/support, clicking the PayPal button. So thanks to Z-Chun.
Heck yeah, man. Appreciate that a ton. And let's see, one time, 12-12, I mean, basically, yeah. I mean, he's going to get some stickers, and I mean, are we still doing patches too?
When they come in through PayPal, I don't get an address. So if you do send a PayPal donation in and you want stickers, yeah, shoot me over your address and I'll send those out.
All right, cool.
Also, Jason Gutierrez came in with a 12-12 donation. So welcome to the flock to Jason.
Heck yeah, man. So another PayPal donation on that one?
Yeah, right. It was good on the PayPal this past week.
All right, that's sweet, man. Jason, get your address to Brandon. And that way, you know, get the little bit of swag that we do give out, at least.
You know what? I kind of feel bad because, you know, we sent out the coffee, the My Morning Hakra and the Full Calf Metcalf, which I now come to find out that they made an official Full Calf Metcalf coffee now. So I guess I have to refer to ours as the unofficial version because so the thing that's got me feeling bad, though, you know, we hit up our top 25 people, but we still have some people in the Ring of Honor who want it. I feel like maybe we need to come up with a donation levels to where if anybody else wants to enjoy these two brews of coffee, that how to get it out to them.
Okay, well, yeah, because you're going to need the extra money to defend yourself in court over intellectual property, it sounds like. So looking forward to doing next season with you and Michael Kendricks in neighboring jail cells. That'll be fun.
Yeah, so if there's an intellectual property lawyer out there that can help defend me in this for when I get the inevitable letter for making some unauthorized batches of Full Calf Metcalf.
Right.
Let me know.
All in a desperate attempt to shill your brother's new coffee joint. So,
yeah. Well, you know what? I think I'm okay because I didn't charge anybody. So, you know, it was just giving those out as gifts to donors. So I'm
sure. Good luck with that.
I'm hoping I'm okay on this.
Yeah, we'll see. Don't worry. I'll come and visit.
Yeah. Yeah. Appreciate it. So we can come up with another name for this coffee that was branded as such. And if there's some people that want that, I need to figure out a way to get it out to folks.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're going to have to get with your brother on costs and stuff there and, you know, make a determination, it sounds like.
I know. I feel like we're having a meeting here and you're not helping me at all. And we should move on.
You're welcome. Yeah, you're welcome.
good business meeting.
Yeah.
Well, here's another piece of business. HawkFan 4716 sends in. Please tell me we get a Seattle Dragons podcast for the off season. Please and thank you.
Unlikely. I think I've made a decision that I'm going to be building a house this summer.
Oh.
And there is not going to be any time to do Seattle Dragons football podcast. That's not going to happen.
Or the snow melts, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. The frost has to come out of the ground before I can start excavating. That's for sure. So, but they, I mean, I'm going to do it all myself as much as possible. Ooh. So yeah, it's not going to be, it's not going to be a lot of extra time.
Good luck with that.
Oh, I big time. Good luck with that. Because, you know how many times I've built a house?
Zero.
Yeah. Yeah. I've remodeled a lot of houses, mm-hmm. but I've never, you know, gone from scratch, but, you know, I mean, it's not rocket surgery.
Generally, like, people hire out people to help with that, but you know, whatever you think you can do.
Well, that's the beauty of having my property out in Granite County, uh-huh. in Montana. Guess how many permits I have to pull?
Probably one, just to let
zero.
You just have to file
zero.
No,
I can just do whatever the hell I want because freedom. It's great.
That's good.
So I don't have to worry about codes. I just have to make sure it holds up. Like, I can do that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Nails can do that.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, I mean, I'm going to do some timber frame. It shouldn't be that hard.
Famous last words.
What could go wrong?
As Adam's loading a fireplace in and out of the back of his pickup truck, what could go wrong?
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, I know sometimes I do dumb things like smash my leg with a fireplace, but I think this will all work out.
All right, moving on to an email from Garrett in Espanola, Ontario. Says, Pete had another great year. Russell played well enough to be considered MVP. Carson had another good year. So did Lockett. And DK is a rising star. Bobby and KJ both had good seasons. Clowney played well. Griffin had a strong season. McDougal is more than just a guy in our scheme. And Diggs is a stud. O-line? Well, we've been here before. What a great season. We got to watch some really entertaining games this year. Top level talent. To win a playoff, and we competed well in our last game of the season too. What other coach do you think could get this team so deep into the playoffs? After everything, Pete Carroll and John Schneider are calling the shots. We have Wilson and Bobby. That's more than most teams are dreaming for. Let's not forget how truly lucky we are to be this spoiled. We have generational talent in coaching and players. We should be proud of this year and happy to look forward to the offseason. Go Hawks, from Garrett.
Yeah, go Hawks, Garrett. I tend to agree with Garrett. I mean, there are definitely things about Pete that drive us all a little crazy. But at the end of the day, on balance, it's far more positive than it is negative.
That's true.
And Garrett points out a zillion things right there.
Yeah. And I will learn to accept the negative things because I just see so many other teams year after year. They're all trying to make the best coaching hire in the offseason with all of the information out there, with all of the meetings, with the in-person interviews. They aren't trying to hire a coach that's going to run the team in the ground. They're trying to find a coach that's going to take them to the playoffs, and they don't. And we already have one of those. And yes, I know there's the people that say one Super Bowl doesn't give you a lifetime pass as coach. And I, mm-hmm. You know what? If Pete Carroll went year after year missing the playoffs and looking like the team had no chance, absolutely. Then you look to move on. But he's not showing any signs of slowing down.
No, and that's the thing. I don't give Pete a lifetime pass. If he goes the next two seasons, like, you know, 5-12 and, you know, that's what I think, 6-10, like, you know, whatever, 5-11, like, it just, I would be pissed and I'd be like, yep, it's time. I think the game has passed him by. But that hasn't been the case. The case has been the opposite. And yeah, like I said, on balance, I will take Pete Carroll.
Jason emails in and says, to me, it seems as if the Seahawks are viewed through the same lens that the media has viewed politics in recent years. Yet no matter how good the Seahawks are, they just get snubbed at every turn, in my opinion. This seems to me that the majority of the options from other journalists or Seahawks fans to sift through and research are mostly lined with negative comments or opinions, which I completely understand that it is their opinion from viewpoints of their own fandom. So this is not a complaint about them, but more of a desire for a balanced source. So thank you for this outlet. This stems from the example of the options that I filter through to gain insight into the NFL teams. Most recent example, in my own opinion, is the constant snubs for Russell Wilson's career that has been exemplary in so many categories, yet he barely gets the recognition that he deserves. Last year, he barely made the Pro Bowl, and yet when he performed there, he seemed to me to be head and shoulders above the competition that surrounded him. Before this season began, the majority of the reports seemed to me that the Seahawks were fools for being a team that dedicated to running the football. Just like the Seahawks were fools for acquiring Russell Wilson and this year DK Metcalf. Yet the same reporters then would declare that the Cowboys needed Zeke Elliott, a running back, to go out and win a Super Bowl. So to me, it was providing me with a point of view that seems to be a double standard. What could be applied to the Cowboys could not be applied to the Seahawks. And now the majority of the teams still in the playoffs are NFL teams that can run the football well. Now, most recently, DK Metcalf just broke an NFL rookie record and a valuable part of the Seahawks offense, but still is not even a backup to the Pro Bowl. Even though he just broke an NFL record by gaining 160 yards in a playoff game by a rookie, no other rookie in NFL history, which is what, 100 years, has done that, yet the recognition that he gets is only from the Seahawks fan base. It's a shame on one hand, and on the other hand, it's just more fuel for their fire to perform at an elite level and reach the highest potential that they could reach. Go Hawks, from Jason.
Dude, go Hawks, Jason. Yeah, he hit on a lot of things that we talked about a little earlier in the podcast, but yes, the double standard in the media is insanely frustrating. We covered that earlier, like I said, in the podcast.
Yeah.
It would be interesting. Well, I guess he kind of gives us credit for being one of the more balanced sources for Seahawks news and that sort of thing. I'd like to believe that. Unfortunately, I think we are biased in a very large way. So I hope at least with this Homer podcast, which it is, that we do try to deliver some sort of semblance of balance.
I mean, we recognize the criticisms. We did that throughout the show, and now we poo-pooed maybe a lot of the criticisms, but yeah, I think at least that we have the sense to recognize that they're out there.
Yeah, and I believe that we generally follow up our observations with facts, logic, and reason, and that seems to help with that sort of thing. Now, we're not always right. I mean, sometimes we'll do things like rank the different divisions and be like dead ass wrong. And yeah. There's things, but because sometimes I also say dumb things, like, and not just do them. So that happens, but we try our best.
Yeah. And that was from Jason, and Jason in Snohomish also emailed us about the divisions. I don't know if that's the same Jason, but I want to put off our division ranking, because I think, yeah, we made some mistakes there trying to do it off the top of our head last week. But Jason's, I think he came up with a list that sets it pretty straight, and I think we'll get to that the next show. One of the other things that Jason pointed out is the Pro Bowl snub for Metcalf, and I think the way that they do the voting and the fact that and there's a lot of good receivers out there. I don't think Metcalf's going to get it in his first year, but he might start getting recognition for years down the road now. And obviously playoffs doesn't play into the Pro Bowl, except for in terms of coaching. And Pete Carroll and the Seahawks were the highest winning team to lose in the divisional round. So now the Seahawks coaches are going to be coaching in the Pro Bowl.
No, I suppose so. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Another reason, or another thing that I won't watch in the Pro Bowl, so that'll be fun.
But it'll give them a chance. I don't know if that gives them a chance to tamper at all with potential free agents, but maybe a little bit. Maybe it helps out in a way.
Yeah, maybe. Hard telling, not knowing. But excuse me for not being able to get excited about anything Pro Bowl related.
Oh no, it's not a fun game to watch. Although if you listen to it, you can picture it as an actual football game, and then it's kind of fun.
No, okay.
Yeah, because you know when you hear Russell Wilson sacked, you know, for 6 yards, you just think of him being violently thrown down by Zadarius Smith. When in actuality, it's him just kind of wrapping his arms around Russell Wilson. So it's just that you hear the when you hear it, it gives you all the visuals that you would expect from an actual football game.
Oh, well, maybe I've just been doing it wrong then. Yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen to the Pro Bowl.
I'm still going to pass. Sorry.
All right, Adam. On to do better and better at life.
All right, man. My do better this week is for our Catfish Kid mutual friend, Jared Tim. And it's very simple. This won't be long. Watching the game, he actually was texting back and forth and being rather supportive throughout the game for a change. I was like, wow, maybe, you know, being a two-time parent now has changed this man. You know, maybe he's, kind of become a more compassionate human being and like, you know, is generally not going to be an asshole to me. And then, you know what he did?
What's that?
We get the ball back. with, what was it, 6 minutes or whatever it was on our last drive?
A little under five, or about five, yeah.
Okay. We get the ball back, and I'm excited, and then a text comes through, and the text says, you guys are definitely going to win this game.
Oh.
And I knew that wasn't because he thought that for reals. He was doing that to be an asshole and reverse jinx the whole thing. And he did. So to Jared Tim, for not changing a stripe on his in his coat, like, he is still a big time catfish head. Do better.
Oh, Jared. That's okay. His Broncos weren't even close to sniffing the playoffs.
It was hilarious because I was listening to a lot of Denver talk radio on my drive back from this weekend's job. And they're all talking about how they can't wait for Tua to fall to them. And I have to do some more on Tua because I do the, you know, the research. Yeah, the every
quarterback
year on the
breakdown.
Yeah. I've watched three games, every throw. I'm not sure what I'm missing because I'm not impressed. Yeah. So I kind of hope that they do draft Tua. That'll be fun for them. I don't know. I'll look at it some more. Maybe I'm just not seeing it. But yeah, initial impressions. I don't know, man. Like, if you want a guy who can throw a slant and a screen, then I guess Tua's your guy. But not a lot else there.
Yeah. Joe Burrow threw some nice deep balls in the national championship.
I have yet to watch it. Have they played the national championship for college?
LSU won.
Oh, okay. Cool.
It was Joe Burrow versus Nordic Jesus.
Yeah, I knew that much. I don't follow college football because it's boring ass football. But and I actually think that helps me evaluate the quarterbacks a little clearer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go watch a little bit of Burrow in that game.
Okay.
I mean, lit up Oklahoma too, but I mean, everybody does that.
Right. I didn't know this until just the other day that he literally spells the Burrow with the Louisiana X. I didn't know that's how.
No, he doesn't.
No, then somebody altered a photo then.
Yes, he did.
How does he spell his name?
B-U-R-R-O-W.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. That's what I'd pictured in my head. Somebody had redone it then. And fell for an internet trick.
Like Go Saints with a E-O-E-U-X.
Yeah, like they do everywhere down there in Louisiana. Because apparently they're obsessed with the letter X.
One other guy obsessed with the letter X. And in terms of his dating profile, Handsome Jimmy is my do better this week. And not for in terms of his dating profile, but for his moment at the end of the Seahawks game. Handsome Jimmy throws the football into the stands and he was fined for it. I don't know why they fine players for throwing the football in the stands, but
footballs
maybe
are expensive. Brandon, they're expensive, and this multi-billion-dollar corporation can't afford the players to just be throwing them away.
Well, as it turns out, this was a pretty valuable football that Garoppolo did throw into the stands because it was the football that was used in the final game in the final moments of the NFL's 100th season.
Oh.
So maybe Garoppolo not having a sense of history for that, but apparently Matt Pinelli was a 19-year-old who shoved another Seahawks fan trying to get the ball that Garoppolo threw into the stands. So congrats to Pinelli for being a
catfish
and and getting that football. But to Jimmy Garoppolo for not even recognizing the moment he was in, the final game of the NFL's 100th season, and just chucking the ball like some souvenir into the stands. Handsome Jimmy, do better.
Yeah, man. I guess he did kind of incite that
catfish-head
behavior in the stands there, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, look, it's just a football. People don't get bent out of shape about it. But you brought up the 100-year thing and being the last regular season game of the NFL's first 100 years, right?
Yeah.
And on the Bill Simmons podcast, I believe it was Cousin Sal who brought up the idea that if it happened to be a Packers Chiefs Super Bowl,
ooh,
that would be the 100th year of the NFL, right? Guess what the first Super Bowl was?
The Chiefs and the Packers.
It kind of comes full circle, right? Which brings me to another point. This is pseudo do better. I'll do this very quickly so that we can move on. Uh-huh. But anybody who's going to like actually have the audacity to root for the 40
catfish
Niners this week, do better.
What Seahawks fan is rooting for the 49ers?
I'm looking at you, Kofi. he definitely put up a post that said something.
That's an
that
emotional
effect.
Reaction to losing to the Packers. I understand that you hate the team that you lose to, and that was the most recent team that we lost to. but we lost the division to the 49ers, and we don't want our division rival winning the Super Bowl. I went as far to root for the Patriots last season against the Rams.
Absolutely. Can you imagine having to deal with a full offseason of, you know, the
bang bang Niner game with their Super Bowl chance?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And acting like they've been a fan of the team for the past like 10 years, even though they probably just came out of the closet and decided to be this year. And the reason I know that is just all the empty stadiums that they played in there for the last 3-4 years. Yeah. So, yeah,
fair weather fan base. They're a fair weather fan base. They don't deserve it.
Fair weather, wine and cheese fan base. That's who they are.
That's where we should be closing the show at, but we still have Better at Life. Fine. My Better at Life this week is for, it's not football related. It's for Australian comedian Celeste Barber, who sparked a huge fundraiser for the fires down in Australia. Cool. She ended up raising $50 million just on the basis of, you know, wanting to start raising money. One of her first tweets that she put out was, "Hey, billionaires, Notre Dame burning down sucked. I get it. Times that by a trillion, and that's what's happening in Australia. Feel free to flick us a couple of million. You make it seem pretty easy." And that tweet got a lot of attention, helped spark her fundraiser, and over 50 million Australian dollars raised through Celeste Barber, just a comedian trying to raise some money for the wildfire efforts. And for doing that, Celeste Barber, Better at Life than Skip Bayless.
Well done. That's very impressive. I think you need to get in touch with Celeste and see if she can't help you with raising a legal defense fund.
Yeah. Maybe I should just promote the real Full Calf Metcalf. Would that put us on the positive side of
you're
the ledger?
You're already in too deep. Yeah, you're screwed. Screwed.
I sent out 25 bags of 4-ounce bags of coffee. Yeah. And now I'm going to be in big trouble.
Yeah.
To get your official Full Calf Metcalf, go to Volcanica Coffee. VolcanicaCoffee.com.
I hope the Volcanica Coffee legal staff heard that and are touched by your free promotion there.
Yeah.
Well, my Better at Life than Skip Bayless this week, Brandon, is for the Brothers Griffin, because they gave us a really cool moment towards the end of the season with that sack. Surprising that's Keem's first sack, considering how much pressure he has brought in the limited opportunities that he got this year. And to team up with Shaq on that sack late in the game, it was just a heartwarming moment. And even in the loss, it's one of those things that makes you feel really great. And it also, I think we talked a little bit about Keem being on this team next year, going into this year, and he was going to need to show something. And I think he really did. And I just, you know, hats off to John Schneider for drafting both those guys. And just being an inspirational story, the Brothers Griffin, Better at Life than Skip Bayless.
Better at Life, indeed. What a cool moment. I just, you know, for it to be that storybook moment, I thought that would have been it to spark the comeback. And we'll just have to settle for it as an awesome moment of Shaquem Griffin's career, getting his first sack against Aaron Rodgers in the playoffs and coming up in such a big moment, too, on third down. So, Better at Life, indeed. And the fact that his brother was there, that, you know, it would have been cool if they maybe shared the sack. But Shaquem Griffin, he deserved that first one.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Shaq would have no problem with Keem being credited with a full sack there.
Shaquille was just trying to be the quickest guy there to congratulate him on it, I think was the deal.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
And with that,
there's only one thing left to say.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks. Let's go 2020.